Coming up on Boston Public Radio, we'll start with the latest from Shutdown City with CNN's John King. Is a default avoiding deal possible? Then Miles O'Brien on Nova's film Megastorm Aftermath, a year after Hurricane Sandy. Are we ready for the next big one?
The editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGrory, on a polarized media driving the shutdown. And the tragic tale of Kurt Schilling. Then a psychologist arguing that psychotherapy has a big-time PR problem. And finally, a new book honoring the best Jewish baseball players. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Hey, it's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hey.
Hey to you, Marjorie. So, President Obama says he's ready to talk, even on Republican terms, as long as Congress acts first to end the government shutdown and raise the debt ceiling. But until Congress budges, the president is trying to get things done in the executive branch. For example, he's poised to nominate Janet Yellen as the head of the Federal Reserve. Joining us to go over these stories and what they mean out of the Beltway is CNN's chief national correspondent. That would be John King. Hello there, John.
They mean, despite the shutdown, the Red Sox opened the championship series on Saturday.
That took about 10 seconds.
I'm glad you can keep your perspective.
Even Washington can't mess with that.
Yeah, you know, it's good. It makes you more healthy, John. No
did you make it to the first base field box with your son on Friday?
I did. I was there both Friday and Saturday. I had a great time in Boston. It was wonderful to be in Boston and see my son, who's doing great at Boston College, and talk to some of his young friends who always ask me about Washington, and now they just shake their heads when they do it. They're like, what? You know what? You know,
God, thank God the feds don't run Fenway Park. It would be like a total disaster, John. But, you know, the president had a press conference yesterday. He said he's ready to talk even on GOP terms as long as Congress acts first to end the shutdown and raise the debt ceiling, even if it's only for a little while. John Boehner's reaction, nothing new here. So we're just kind of still stuck.
There's some new here, Jim and Marjorie, which is what makes it both interesting and frustrating at the same time. If you listen to the president yesterday, you know, the Democratic base could all jump up and down because he said he used the word extortion. He said he wasn't going to be held hostage. He said he wouldn't negotiate. And then he sort of, in the next breath, said, but, you know, since they don't trust me, if they want, I'll put in writing what I'm willing to talk about if they will open the government and raise the debt ceiling. So the president essentially said, I am willing to negotiate. I just want to do it in a sequence to my liking, not to your liking. So this is time for adult leadership, and we don't have any at the moment. But if you look at what Paul Ryan wrote in the Wall Street Journal today, it's very interesting. Remember, he was the hero of conservatives on fiscal matters for the last four or 5 years. And he writes this op-ed that says, okay, children, time to get this over with. Let's reopen the government. Let's raise the debt ceiling. And let's do modest entitlement reforms and modest tax reform. He doesn't even want the big grand bargain. He wants sort of an in-between. He says, let's get started. Let's do this as confidence building. And he cites a couple of efforts that are truly bipartisan, that aren't at full agreement yet, but that have prospect to be at agreement. And he says, let's do it. Now, there it is in writing. So you could open the government, raise the debt ceiling, and put and essentially just staple the Paul Ryan Wall Street Journal op-ed to the bill raising the debt ceiling, and you get where the president said he was willing to go yesterday. The problem is Republicans won't do it. If the House would just do that, I think we'd get this done quickly.
Well, is it true? I mean, I heard on your place on CNN last night that they're really, and I've never heard of this before, that the parties really aren't talking. There are no back channels. Essentially, they speak through the media was the point made on CNN last night. Is that really so?
It is so, with the exception of, you know, the president has called the speaker once or twice to have a couple minute long conversations, and they all came to the White House for that, you know, one meeting last week that went for a couple of hours. But there's no secret back channel, in part because the back channel the last couple times around has been Joe Biden, and Harry Reid got mad at the White House over that, saying, you know, stop sending the vice president up to work my Senate. That's my job. And so there's some, we talk about the internal Republican feuding all the time. There's some internal Democratic shenanigans going on as well here. But the interesting thing is that, you know, that Paul Ryan piece, guys, did not mention Obamacare. It did everything but.
Yeah.
And yet, so the Ted Cruz wing of the party comes out today and says, no way, Paul Ryan. So here's the guy who was your vice presidential nominee. For 5 years, 6 years before that, he was your hero on fiscal matters for conservatives. But now the new Ted Cruz wing, I guess, says he's part of the establishment too, so they don't like or trust him. That's the problem. You have this wing of 25 to 50 House and a few Senate conservatives, depending on the issue, it's 25 or maybe up to 40 or 50, who they don't trust anybody. Not only do they not trust President Obama, they don't trust their own leadership.
Is it really true? I mean, there was a piece that we were just talking about, where Brian McGorry is going to be with us at 1 o'clock, and one of his reporters wrote a piece, the editor of the Boston Globe wrote a piece about John Boehner, and basically framed it without using these words. He either wins the Profile in Courage Award or he becomes a footnote in history.
Rather disgraceful footnote in history, I think.
If John Boehner, according to CNN and your vote count, he realistically has the votes if he wants to put this to a vote, despite what he says. The, as you say, former Republican vice presidential nominee weighs in, and I assume Eric Cantor, the number two guy, goes wherever his boss goes, John Boehner. Is the only reason Boehner's not doing this because he's afraid he's going to be deposed by the Tea Party Republicans if he cuts a deal? Is that it?
It's not quite that simple. He does view his job as the leader of a group to listen to everybody in the group. And since there's not two or three of them, there are, 25 to 40 of them, depending on the day and the issues at hand. And that's, more than 10% of his group. It's sometimes up as high as 15 or 20% of his group. And as a leader, he feels he has the right to listen to them. Now, you can all roll your eyes out there saying he's defending John Boehner. John Boehner's afraid to lose his job. No, losing his job is part of it. I'm not trying to sugarcoat that. I've known John Boehner a long time. And for anybody out there who followed, the late Senator Kennedy's career, there would be no child left behind if it weren't for John Boehner. He cut the deal with then-Senator Kennedy when he was in the House. There would be no Medicare prescription Part D, whether you like or don't like that program, without John Boehner and Mitch McConnell, for that matter. They cut these deals. These are governing conservatives. They're legislators. They believe you start right of center, you count the votes, you cut your best deal, and you move on, and then you try to win the next election and try to cut a better deal. But they both have problems now in their own restless and sometimes rebellious wings of their party. As leaders, they have to listen to them. I think as we get closer to this debt ceiling deadline, we're going to see, John Boehner has done it a couple times in the past when it's looked really, really messy. At the last minute, he's gone into the room and says, here's my play. You're either with me or you're not. And he's kept most of them, and he's won the big votes. We're going to see, I think, within a week, if that's going to play out.
John King from CNN, I wondered, I read somewhere, I forget where, that Obama had an off-the-record meeting with a bunch of conservative journalists yesterday. Paul Gigot, the Wall Street Journal editorial page editor, and Kathleen Parker writes for the Washington Examiner, et cetera. Was that unusual? What do you make of that?
Obama talking to reporters, period, is unusual.
Yeah.
It just is. I'm sorry. This was supposed to be the most transparent administration in history, and it's very rare that he has these gatherings. And I think they're good. I think they're good. I covered the White House for almost 9 years, and both Bill Clinton and George Bush got hot and cold with us on occasion. But we had more access to them and their top guys than people do to the Obama team. So I think it's good that he's sitting down with people with whom he disagrees and who write some not-so-nice things about him on an almost daily basis, to try to get a better understanding. If they can understand, this is the problem in Washington right now. Everybody has their position, and they think they're right, and they refuse to listen to the other side, and they refuse to respect the other side. You can't get anything done if you don't at least respect the other side. This is why the president, we have divided government. The price of admission in divided government is negotiation. So the president's "I won't negotiate" has never been real. I get what he's doing, and I'm not criticizing him. He has to defend his turf and use whatever leverage he has. He's essentially saying, I'll look left, you have to open the government, then I look right, we negotiate. It's not part of the same piece of paper, so I didn't break my promise not to negotiate. It's all sequencing and depends on your definition of negotiation, I guess. But if he can win the respect of a few of these conservative columnists, or at least explain his position better, maybe they will help get us to compromise. Maybe they will write a piece that gets a Ted Cruz or some Tea Party member of the House to say, aha, I get it now, let's try this. So it's smart on the president's part.
But it's smart. But how can he make the case credibly that everything has to be clean, as is the term of the day, and we'll talk later, when, what was it, just 2 years ago, he cut deals on pretty massive deficit reduction. What was it, $1 trillion or something like that? in the context of the exact same kind of circumstance. So putting aside Obamacare for a minute, in terms of deficit reduction or cuts in entitlements, or he already has embraced a means testing of Medicare and the so-called chain CPI, a slower inflation adjustment to Social Security. Why isn't that precedent for dealing with the Republicans in the framework of the default slash shutdown?
Well, that is the argument that the Republicans make, Mr. President. You know, we did this with you last time, and we're going to do it with you this time. There are those in the White House, and there are certainly those outside of the White House in the Democratic Party who think that deal was a mistake, think that deal gave up too much. That's one of the reasons Harry Reid doesn't want Joe Biden up in the Senate, because he was part of that deal. And so, essentially, the White House would tell you that that was a mistake, or that they shouldn't, you know, they had to do it that way once because we were on the verge of this, but you can't do it every time. You know, you can't run the government like a daycare center or a fire drill every time, so they're not going to do it again. But you're absolutely right. The precedent is there. And if you look back, you know, this has been done, again, with a wink nod by almost every president in the last 25 years, maybe not on the specific legislation. So a piece of paper passes that raises the debt ceiling, and there's nothing else in it or nothing significant in it. So the president can say, I didn't negotiate the debt ceiling. And then 20 minutes later, they pass something that, you know, repaints his house and, you know, sells his car because that was the term of the negotiation. Which that's fine. I think the American people are fine with that. And you can call it whatever the hell you want. Just get the government open and don't default.
Okay, I'm getting a shutdown headache. So very quickly, John King, do you want to do Nostradamus here? How does this end and when? Or do you not want to do that?
No, I'll be careful because I don't know. And I think that one of the things, this has never been done like this before. You don't hold up Obamacare, you know, you don't hold up the government over a policy dispute. It's never been done before. So that's why the president and the Democrats rightly say, this has never been done before. The Republicans can't do this. But we're in a whole new world here where the Republican Party is in a civil war where lots of things, they don't pass budgets anymore. And that's both the Democrats and the Republicans' fault. A lot of things are done like they've never been done before. So in some ways, that doesn't stick. I do think, look, Boehner does not want to be the House Speaker who has the deadline passed and the United States going to default. Do I think if, let's say, that, you know, is the deadline the 15th or the 17th, so that means it could be the 19th. Do I think we could go past it 48 hours, and everybody knows the government can figure that out for 48 hours? But I do think within that window, either a day before or 2 days after, they will pass something that will reopen the government at the Republican spending levels. It will raise the debt ceiling. I don't think they want to do it. They may do a temporary one, but Republicans don't want to vote twice on this. So that's why that one doesn't have that much appeal. If they do a temporary one, it will be because they get in writing and the president will have to sign the piece of paper before they give him a longer debt ceiling increase that he's going to negotiate entitlements and tax reform. I think we're going to get there. I may be crazy, but I think that there are more sane people in the Congress than insane people in the Congress. Maybe not by much, but I do think there are more sane than insane.
Boy, I hope so, because I'm getting very nervous. So John King from CNN, Larry Summers, the controversial former president of Harvard University, made a few missteps regarding women and their capabilities in science and so forth around here. He dropped out. He was Obama's first choice to head up the Federal Reserve. And today, Obama's expected to nominate Janet Yellen, who's been the vice chair there for years, to be the first actually woman to head the Fed. Is this going to become a big stink, or is she going to be approved without too much of a fight?
I think she'll be approved without too much of a fight. I think the Republicans are going to fight about the policy here in the debt ceiling and the like. I think you'll have some tough questions when she goes up before the committees about interest rates, about Fed policy, about monetary policy, which the libertarian, you know, Rand Paul, former Ron Paul wing of the party, cares about monetary policy. But she is widely respected in both parties. She has a history with the older senators from her days in the Clinton administration, not just from her days on the Fed now. And so the committees that get that one, she's in good standing. And at a time Republicans are being accused of, you know, mischief with the economy on this debt ceiling stuff and the shutdown stuff, I don't think they want to do it when it comes to the Fed.
Okay, John King, you have 50 words or less. This is John King's Federal Reserve for Dummies. Explain to the listeners why we should care who the head of the Federal Reserve is. Go.
Well, no, there is an issue about, do they continue to keep interest rates low? Does the fear of inflation kick in? And over her history, she has been more in favor of raising interest rates to keep inflation in rein. She's known as more of an unemployment hawk than an interest rate hawk like Ben Bernanke. It affects the cost of the loan on your house and the cost of the loan in your car, and it could impact down the road the cost of your, you know, loan for your kids' college education. So what it costs you to borrow is deeply impacted by what the Fed does.
That was excellent.
She's also expected to be tougher on Wall Street than Larry Summers would have been were he selected, right?
I think that's right. The Fed doesn't regulate Wall Street, but it does, you know, keep an eye on Wall Street to the degree that it, some of its policies or some of its lending policies and open policies and interest rate policies are what can encourage some of the freewheeling conduct that we've seen in Wall Street, both good and bad. So I think that is a fair way to say it.
Okay, so you're a kid from Dorchester. Marjorie and I both like you, so we're going to play this for you to lift your spirits for the rest of a difficult day. Here it is.
Victorino broken back. Long run for Escobar. He's got to hurry.
Is your pulse beating quickly, John?
It's amazing to me, having grown up with the old Red Sox, station to station, three-run homer. If you got to go from first to third, you need to call a cab. I mean, to watch a team that says speed kills. I mean, this is not your father's Red Sox, boys and girls, and I love it.
You couldn't get much happier. Well, on to the next round, John King from CNN. Thanks so much for your time, John.
Thank you, John. John King is the chief national correspondent for CNN. He's with us every Tuesday at noontime. When we come back, we're going to look at what we've learned in the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy. It was the deadliest and most destructive hurricane of the 2012 hurricane season in the Atlantic, the second costliest in our history. Was it a freak? Was it more like hurricanes to come? And if so, are we prepared? A new WGBH NOVA documentary takes these questions on, and we're going to have that conversation next on Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. If Mitt Romney's binder's full of women, remember that? If that quote didn't help to elect President Obama to a second term, Hurricane Sandy arguably did. You remember Governor Chris Christie's figurative and nearly literal embrace of Obama in the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy. Mayor Bloomberg's emphatic endorsement of the president may have changed the outcome of the 2012 presidential election. So while we're well aware of how Hurricane Sandy may have affected U.S. politics, we're far less sure about how prepared the U.S. is to endure another storm. Joining us in Studio 3 to go over what we learned from Hurricane Sandy and how far we need to go to protect the U.S. from future similar storms is Miles O'Brien. He's the writer and producer of NOVA's Megastorm Aftermath, premiering tonight at 9, 8 Central on PBS. Check your local listings. Miles, good to see you again.
Great to be with Miles. You both. Good to see you.
First of all, congratulations. It is a spectacular and very upsetting program that you put together that people can see tonight.
Spectacular and upsetting. That's good to get both of those.
Oh, it is.
Yeah, that's good.
It is. I mean, the photography and the scenes of destruction and just the fear that we're not going to address any of this. But first, let's start with Sandy. How far along are they in recovering down there from New Jersey? It doesn't sound like they're very far along at all.
It's pretty stopgap.
Yeah.
And, the mayor, Mike Bloomberg, outgoing mayor, came up with a rather significant plan, a $20 billion plan, which involved a series of flood walls and some beach renourishment and allowing some barrier islands to be sprouting up in New York Harbor. But the big question that a lot of experts have asked is, should there be sort of a fortress built around the New York metropolitan region, barriers, storm surge barriers, as they do, of course, in the Netherlands and St. Petersburg, Russia, Venice, those places that have spent a lot of money, many billions, on huge infrastructure to literally stem the tide? And that question, Bloomberg has dismissed it. The question is, what will his successors think? What will the Corps of Engineers say? And really, who's got the money to do this?
Well, actually, speaking of that, you have a scientist. We'll hear from him first, followed by Mayor Bloomberg on that very topic.
We have to start to retreat from the most exposed waterfront.
As New Yorkers, we cannot and we will not abandon our waterfront. It is one of our greatest assets.
Well, that's resolved.
Yeah, it's not resolved. Well, when you talk about the barriers and so forth, you have a great scene of a retired firefighter who put, a pretty impressive stone fortification, rocks, all these big rocks in front of his house. What good did it do him?
Yeah, this is a great story. Dan Mundy, he's this town, is just a little spit of land along
the Rockaways.
Never heard of it. Yeah, Broad Channel. So tiny little place, and it's multi-generational. These are firefighters and cops. These are blue-collar people who have this incredible little spot right on the water there. He put 240 tons of revetment, rock, in front of his house, hoping that would keep him safe
from
whatever would happen.
Huge.
And Sandy went right over the wall.
Yeah.
And so he's out there now trying to rebuild the barrier islands, which have gone away in Jamaica Bay, which are nature's natural speed bump for all these waves and for the high water.
And many of the people are not back in their houses at all.
Well, there was a story last week about people finally moving out or being forced out of hotels, $400 a night hotels, some to homeless shelters and some to apartments they were able to find.
You know, until we address this issue of whether we should be living in these places, the big issue here is, you know, does it make any sense to be building on barrier islands, rebuilding and moving right back in? We're just going to play this out over and over again. And I believe that is the definition of insanity.
Well, you asked the question, is it a freak event or a window into our future, obviously a question about climate change. And while I think it raises the issues beautifully in your film, there was a Pew Center poll that came out a few days ago. And you'd think after Sandy, this would change. They asked people about the 21 highest priorities for the United States of America. You know what came in dead last at 21? Climate change.
Yeah.
Even after Sandy, every night on television, we saw these, I don't care what your politics are, what your belief about climate change is, you saw these incredibly pained scenes of people being displaced, if not killed, by the force of nature, which most of us thought we were totally invulnerable to.
What will it take? We've had Andrew, we've had Katrina, we've had Sandy, Irene up in Vermont. I mean, when you think of all these storms repeatedly coming through, when are we going to start to address this? Why isn't there a comprehensive debate here in Boston, a low-lying city,
yes,
in the wake of Sandy? It could just as easily have been Boston as it was
New York.
If
it had made a slight turn, right?
A slight turn, and you guys would have been dealing with it. And there's no conversation on a national level about this. We have other things going on, as John King laid out very well, that have distracted us from this is a very fundamental, really an existential issue.
Well, the other thing, too, that I think I falsely thought was going to protect some people is that, you know, you talked about how many feet above sea level certain areas were, like the Battery and Battery Park in New York City, 8 feet above sea level. And yet that was just people were walking around to their thighs in water after Sandy. So that's it. In Boston, the Back Bay, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't even think that is above sea level. Wasn't it built?
I don't know.
It's above sea level, but it's landfill. And if you look at the flood projection, you can go to climatecentral.org and, you know, use the little bar to figure out what the flooding is projected flooding over the course of years. And one area that really gets hit is Cambridge. It's very low lying the way the river plays up there. And so there's a lot.
One of us lives there. Thank you.
So this should be a national discussion. We are not talking, you know, Winston Churchill once said, you can always count on Americans to do the right thing after they've exhausted every other option, right? I think we're in the every other option point right now. And eventually we're going to have to deal with it.
Well, let's forget the long term. I don't mean forget like it's unimportant. It's obviously hugely important. Forget whether we can have the big debate about climate change. How about the short term thing? If there was a Sandy today or next month or a year from today, are we any more prepared in the wake of what happened in October of last year than we were then?
You know, the truth is you go to a place like the Netherlands, which is the ultimate long-term thinkers. They build flood walls for, you know, once in 4,000-year floods. You know what they say over there? We salute you Americans for your immediate response. You guys are great immediate responders. We do a good job, generally speaking.
Except
take Katrina aside.
Maybe, right.
But maybe we've learned some lessons from that. I mean, the response post-Sandy generally was pretty good when you consider the magnitude of that. So that's our strong point. What we don't do is we don't think once in 4,000 years. We're Americans. 4,000 years, what's that? We don't, you know, we have no concept of that, right?
But it's not about 4,000 years. It seems my attitude, and I think this is the attitude of most Americans, is we're oblivious to any horror, whether it's an Al-Qaeda horror or a natural horror like Sandy, until it happens. And then all of a sudden, in the wake of terrorism, 12 years ago, we did ramp up in a lot of ways. We are having those debates, and there is greater security. Some think there's too much security. It's invading our privacy. But at least it's there. I don't get the sense from the reading I do, and I'm obviously nowhere near as immersed in it as you are, that even immediate stopgap things are being done in case there's Sandy Part 2.
Well, it has been complicated by the fact that for years and years in this country, the whole scientific discussion about climate change was obscured, the waters muddied by a political spin. And unfortunately, for many years, there were factions in this country that were trying to lead us to believe it wasn't happening. Well, whether you believe it's man-made or natural, and whatever the case may be, the numbers are the numbers. Sea level is rising. The storms are getting worse. That is a fact. And it's time we got beyond that debate and the time we lost in that debate and started thinking about how we adapt to this problem.
And is it a function of the fact that we don't spend money on anything we don't have to anymore? I mean, my attitude is why you don't fix a lot of problems that government could do is there's a calculation by elected officials, not all of them, but a calculation. Is the problem that I'm not dealing with, public pensions or weather or whatever, is it going to create a disaster while I'm here? And if it's not, let the next generation of Paul deal with it. Is that what it's about? Is it about tight budgets or what is it?
Let's think about it. We're talking about 2 or 4 or maybe 6 year cycles for politicians, talking about a problem that's going to bite us in 100 years.
Well,
so,
it would be that
you know,
long?
I
don't know. I mean,
actually,
things
sooner.
Are speeding up, it seems like. I worry that Cape Cod is going to be underwater selfishly because my sister and I have my parents' house down there. How long before Cape Cod's underwater? That's my question every time I discuss this.
Sooner than you think.
Like 50 years?
Places. Well, you know, we're talking in between 2 and 5 feet of sea level rise in the next 100 years, assuming one of those big ice sheets doesn't drop into the ocean in Antarctica. If that happens, we're going to have a big problem very quickly, and then we will be discussing this as a top priority.
So we got away from what should we do. I mean, some of the people that you read about in New Jersey, they're building their homes on stilts. Mm-hmm. There was talk in Boston, the guy that was building the apartment building to raise up the first 2 floors so they'd be above, higher up for a hurricane. That somehow doesn't seem to me to make sense, but I could be totally wrong.
Well, it's part of the big picture. Ultimately, I think, as we just heard from, Klaus Jacob in that brief clip, we're going to have to start pulling back from the water eventually. But in the meantime, we can start thinking about ways of, building higher or making the first floor more impervious to water or floating structures, that kind of thing. In the Netherlands, they're pushing very hard on floating structures, giant floating buildings. That's kind of the short-term thing. But ultimately, we have built a society that is, we've had stable climate for 6,000 or 7,000 years. Civilization has built right to the edge of that.
Right.
And as the temperatures go up and the sea level goes up, we're going to have to adapt. And unfortunately, we have a lot of infrastructure in place and things are happening faster than we can easily adapt to.
And some I assume that from what you're saying, most American cities are not taking a Netherlandian approach to this, for lack of a better expression. Some cities are implementing engineering changes and things now, are they not? Prevent the worst of this?
Yeah. New Orleans is a great example. In the wake of Katrina, the Corps of Engineers went down there with congressional support and back when they were spending money like this and built a $14.5 billion storm surge barrier flood wall around that city. Now, the next time a Katrina happens, they are pretty well protected down there. There's a lot of other issues they need to concern themselves with, like the loss of the wetlands and the delta, which provide a natural barrier. New York, at least, for what it's worth, Mike Bloomberg did put a proposal out there. Now, he's going to be outgoing. Who knows where that goes? The truth is one mayor is not enough. It's at least regional, really a federal problem that needs to be addressed at that level. And I don't see a lot of focus in Washington on this issue.
Marjorie, is it Plum Island? Where was the place that had all the problem with the waterfront houses that were disappearing a few months ago? I think it was Plum Island recently, and I'm sure someone will call in a second if I'm wrong. Correct me. I interviewed the head of environmental protection. We had Deval Patrick, the governor here, and both of them pretty much said, there's only so much we can do. There is going to be some point in the relatively near future, the point that scientist made a minute ago, where you can't protect a Plum Island or a whatever. But very few politics. It takes a lot of you-know-what, it seems to me, when voters are living in a place to say it's only a matter of time till you and your children are not going to be able to live there anymore.
It's tough. The thing is, what they did in the Netherlands, after years and years of building dikes and levees like they do over there, they recognized that this problem, they had finally kind of reached the end of their sorcery, and they came up with this plan, Room for the River. And they've been systematically buying people out and moving levees back to allow these rivers more room when it comes time for the flood seasons. Now, there's cultural differences there in the Netherlands, but bottom line was they wrote them a decent check and they moved on, or they built them mounds that they could prop up so they'd be safe from the flood. If we're going to start doing this, we got to start being serious about writing checks for people to move. And so far, that hasn't happened.
What's with the Netherlands? A couple of weeks ago, we were doing a thing. Who were we talking to? Oh, Nicole Friedman, who's the bike czarina for Boston.
The Netherlands leading the way
and
there,
we were
too.
Quoting a piece that Martine Powers, two-part series that Martine Powers did in The Globe, about where the Netherlands is so far ahead of the rest of the world on the cutting edge of bike safety and bike commutes and that
it's
sort
amazing.
Of stuff. But what is it about the society, the culture, that has caused them to be so far, so forward-looking in a whole variety of these things, most of which cost a lot of money?
Well, as somebody told me, they cannot figure why on earth anyone would settle there in the first place. So they, it's this marshy delta of three giant rivers. And I think that adversity that they sort of built themselves out of has created a certain ethos among them. And they're very industrious people. And geez, the bikes and bike paths are extraordinary. It's amazing. The lifestyle they have there is incredible.
You know, I want to ask you what Boston should be doing. But before I do, you mentioned we need to start writing checks. One of the things I found upsetting in the stories I read in preparation for coming here today was how this flood insurance that is being demanded of people that live along the waterfront is really, really expensive. And you found that people in Sandy would have houses that were worth $350,000 that were totally wiped out, and they'd wind up getting $93,000 back from the flood insurance. So that obviously, in many cases, that's not any kind of guarantee to people either. Well, and those premiums are huge.
Yeah, the flood insurance issue is a really hard thing to unwind, because for years and years, the federal government has been subsidizing essentially bad behavior. Congress has changed this now. And what's happening in places like Broad Channel in New York is people are getting orders of magnitude increases in their insurance. Now, you could say, well, they're living on the water. That's their risk. These are multi-generational families. These are, you know, guys who take the A train to work in Manhattan. They will have to leave. And it's not like – this is not like you're changing the insurance rates on a guy who lives in the Hamptons or
right.
in the Vineyard. And so we have to come up with a way of phasing this in. It's the right thing to do, but should we do it overnight is the question.
And what should Boston be doing? Because we are very close. You know, we're not much above sea level at all. What do we do?
Well, you need to start at least looking at the idea of storm surge barriers, that kind of protection.
Where, in the harbor?
Yeah, maybe in the harbor. I mean, it's the kind of thing that should be thought about. People should start thinking about structures if you're in low-lying areas. Do you have, you know, all your critical electrical infrastructure, phone infrastructure in the first floor of the basement? Should you raise it up? Little things like that make a huge difference, because if the water comes in and you haven't lost your electrical and your phone and your furnace, you know, you can rebound much more quickly. You have a resilience that you don't have now. So on an individual level, you can make decisions. Collectively, there needs to be a discussion about how you protect a region.
Let me borrow a phrase from another station, not PBS, where Nova's Megastorm Aftermath, that you're the writer and producer of, airs tonight. I know you report, and then theoretically we decide. But is that the is what you just said to Marjorie, is that the moral of the story of this film of yours?
I would like people to walk away thinking that this is an important issue that we're not talking about in this country. And at the very least, we should be having conversations in Boston, in Houston, Charleston, South Carolina, about that this is real, that the sea level's rising, the storms are worsening, it's not going to get better. And at the very least, we should be thinking about what we're going to do and how we build and whether we should come up with collective ways of protecting ourselves. We're not doing that right now.
Can you meet Marjorie on the Cape over the weekend and see if you
we'll
can help her shore up the...
What are you talking about? You better put your furnace on the roof in Cambridge. Miles was saying Cambridge is in big trouble, too. But you really think the Cape could be gone within 50 years?
Well, it's just, you know, like I say, I mean...
I'm going to stay a shock.
There are some scientists who would tell you that the estimates are very conservative in the IPCC report,
yeah.
the UN report, and that with you know, one of these glaciers dropping into the ocean, it really could turn into sudden sea level rise. So, you know, one of the scientists we spoke to said if you really want to protect, you know, New York, you should assume 10 feet of sea level rise over the next 100 years. Well, do the math on that. In 50 years, that's 5 feet. Where is your house on the Cape?
I'm not near the ocean.
Okay. Well,
maybe I'll make it.
You might make it.
Listen to the two of them. Listen to this. Miles O'Brien.
You get this tiny little island.
I used to want to be on the ocean, but forget
not
that
so much.
Now.
Okay.
Great to see you again, Miles.
Okay, Miles O'Brien is the writer and producer of this absolutely fantastic Nova Megastorm Aftermath. It premieres tonight at 9 p.m., 8 Central on PBS. Check your local listings and watch it. It's really important and great stuff. When we come back, we're going to look at how a device that is designed to make us more social actually brings out our most anti-social instincts. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie is a little anxious here. I am Jim Browdy. Are you one of those people who's glued to your smartphone, but the minute you get a call from someone you even love and love talking to, you decline the call? Well, Kaylee Widger Wolfson does. She wrote a great piece in the New York Times entitled, "Why I Silence Your Call Even When I'm Free." Does this describe you? It does describe me. As part of the burden of having a mobile phone, the guilt that comes with declining calls when you just aren't in the mood to talk or you don't have the time. Our number is 877-301-8970. 877-301-8970.
Okay, she describes a situation where she's home going through her email, checking her Twitter feed.
Refreshing her Twitter feed every 2 minutes.
Yes, that's right. And one of her nearest, dearest friends, whom she loves and loves to talk to, calls. And she knows this woman is in duress. I mean, her relationship is breaking up and she may have to move and so forth and so on. But she sees her call and she doesn't take the call. She feels it's an intrusion. She wants this woman to text her to make an appointment to call. And this poor woman leaves her a message, one of her closest friends, weeping and sobbing and doesn't even listen to the message.
She does not listen to the message for a week. And we want to know if Kaylee Wolfson Widger and I are you or not. And by the way, there is a divide like there is in so many issues here. I almost never answer the phone. I do respond to people, almost never answer the phone. Marjorie will answer the phone even if it comes up bill collector on her 877-301-8970. It is an incredible piece. She writes this in this wonderful New York Times piece. A week later, she texted, meaning the woman who called, who was having a tough time.
She was sobbing and weeping, Jim.
"Can you talk tomorrow at 9:15 or 2? And the writer says, "I was actually quite busy that day preparing to host a company event in the evening with Stacey's." Prefacing her call with a text felt different. It felt softer, less intrusive. I replied, "I'll call you at 2. 877-301-8970. I assume, other than you, that most people don't answer their phone anymore. That's the beauty. Caller ID is one of the great things that ever happened. And as you said, you'll hear a little bit later something else that's relevant to this. But I just don't answer the phone. It is not because I won't communicate with people. I often don't listen to the voicemail right away. I do text them back and saying, "Is something urgent?" Marjorie, let me ask, even though you're shaking your head at me, as you want to do, what do I do before I call you unless it's an emergency?
You will call me. You will text me and say, "Are you callable?
Are you called?" Right, which is the polite way to initiate a phone conversation. And if you either
but
don't respond to it
do
or say
call,
no.
And since you have a blocked thing, I know that it's
it
you.
It says blocked call.
Most people don't have blocked call.
Restricted call.
Maybe Barack Obama has restricted.
Yes, me and Barack Obama.
You and Barack Obama have restricted call. So I know it's Jim. And your phone conversations last about 4.5 seconds, so I don't have to worry that it's going to take away from anything I'm doing. But you know what else you've noticed, too? Especially with your kids, teenagers or young 20s, nobody leaves messages anymore. One of my kids will call. They never leave a message. So they text. That's what you have to do.
You mean you see that they called and you check the voicemail and there isn't one?
There is no message. Yeah. No, they don't leave messages. And if I leave a message, they never listen to it. So you have to text the children. I've even found this as a reporter. If you want to talk to somebody now, the best thing to do is email or text. People get really annoyed when you call them. They don't like it.
Does it ever occur to you not to answer the phone? You will, by the way, if you call Marjorie, if you happen to have her phone number, if not, I'll give it out in a couple of minutes.
Okay, thank you.
If you call her on deadline, for example, on Monday or Wednesday night, and you know she's finishing at 7 or 7:30, whatever it is. If you call at 6:30, I know that she's not going to answer because she's on deadline. What does she do? She answers the phone. I mean, it is insane. And it is not rude. It is not antisocial. It is just the way things are in 2013. There are different ways to communicate to people that I think are a little bit more respectful. And you know what the beauty is? It also gives you a lot more time to communicate with a lot more people than being on a 10-minute phone call with someone you're not dying to talk to.
I think we are just more hermit-like. I mean, remember the olden days when the phone would ring in your house and you had no idea who it was and you answered the phone as a matter of course. Maybe you didn't answer the phone in the middle of dinner or something like that. A lot of people grew up in families where the rule was you didn't answer the phone during dinner, but except for that, you just answered the phone. And it was like a crapshoot. You never knew who was going to be on the other end, but you picked it up. That's all. We like to be in our little world with our emails and our Twitter feed and our computers, and that's it. 877-301-8970. 877-301-8970. This is very difficult if you have like an 85-year-old mother or something.
Well, then if you have an 85-year-old mother, maybe you should pick up the phone. Here's what this woman writes, and then we'll get to your calls. I'd been coasting along on what seems like a new new norm, and then in italics, nobody picks up. Why should I? And that, with the exception of Marjorie, I would bet of the people who call us at 877-301-8970, I would bet 90% of them, whether they like it or not, Marjorie, are more like me in this context, in this way at least, than they are like you.
Oh, we just got a really great email. I don't know what this guy's name is. He emails us a lot, but he says he gets really annoyed when people do answer. He wants the answering machine when he calls them, and if they pick up, not a good thing.
You know, there's a solution for that, which I told you about ages ago, but you're not the kind of person to use. You ever heard of Sly Dial?
What's that?
Gets you directly into someone's voicemail and by, so even if they're there and once, you don't know about Sly Dial? It's perfectly legal. Yeah, it is. You go directly into the voicemail.
Oh, tell me about that after the show. Well, why don't you tell everybody about it? How do you do it?
I'm not telling you.
Sly Dial?
Sly Dial.
S-L-Y?
Sly Dial.
All right, I'm
checking. In any case, let's
write that down.
I bet you 90% of the callers are just like me and this woman who wrote a great piece. You can Google it. Kaylee Wolfson Widger is her name, W-I-D-G-E-R. Alex, you're in Gardner. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. We almost didn't take your call, Alex. We wanted you to text, but we'll take it anyway. Hi, Alex.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
So I am like you in that I have a habit of not answering my phone calls when I see it ringing. But one of the things I've been thinking about is that I grew up out in Western Massachusetts. Out there, we still have dead zones everywhere.
Yeah.
So we have an excuse to be antisocial at the very least out there. We can get away with it. It's one of the few advantages we have of being so still disconnected from the modern world in a lot of ways.
And your point is you can say you're in a dead zone even if you're not. Is that your point?
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Well, the good news for me, even though I spend most of my life in urban eastern Massachusetts, Center Street, which is what I take from WGBH to NECN in the afternoons, has about a half mile of dead zone as well.
Does.
So I can use the same trick. Alex, thank you so much for the call.
Yeah, when someone asked you a difficult question, what? I couldn't hear you. Bad sell.
You are a much more polite woman than I am a man.
Well,
and I know. Well,
it's
I
not
know.
Going
okay,
far,
fine.
Jim.
But I'm serious. Do you think it's as long as you respond quickly, as long as you send a text, or if you were tweeting someone, whatever it is, as long as you communicate back to the person who's reached out to you, is that disrespectful? I mean, what is the obligation to answer the phone? Someone is saying, I want to talk, communicate with you. You write back and say, I'd love to communicate with you. What's up? Or maybe I can talk. It sort of breaks your rhythm in the day. The decision has been made that your time is such that it can be invaded, even though no one's asked you if it's okay to invade.
Well, that's her thinking. That it's intrusive to expect that you
intrusive.
Should be answering the phone. What I do with people I talk to at great length, and there are a couple of people I do talk to at great length, I take the dog for a walk.
Yeah.
So I'm killing two birds with one stone. I'm talking to people at great length, I'm taking the dog for a walk, and it's a twofer kind of deal.
It's really old school. You still take the dog for a walk. It's incredible. In 2013.
Well, I could lower him on a window in a box, I suppose.
Zane, Seekonk, you're next.
Hi,
on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Zane.
Good afternoon.
Hey.
I'm first and foremost, I'm glad you took my call. Secondly,
good point, Zane.
As somebody in their early 20s, a vast majority of my friends will, you know, either silence the call or out and out reject it. And that, to me, because I generally don't do that. I don't even have a smartphone. And in my humble opinion, I think smartphones make people look a little dumb.
They can.
So
you're one of those old school 20-somethings who actually answers the phone? Is that your point?
I'd say 85% of the time I'm answering the phone. The other 15% of the time I'm swearing at the phone because it's ringing and I'm in the middle of something that I really can't be answering the phone, working on. Like, I do a lot of mechanic work and that kind of thing. So if I'm under a car, I don't want to be answering the phone, and it just pisses me off when it rings.
Well, I think it's a good idea if you're under a car to wait a little bit. So, but for the 85%, Zane, that you do answer, you're the person we wanted to talk to. Why do you do it? Out of guilt? Out of social responsibility? Why do you answer a phone call? You want to talk to the person? What is it?
If somebody comes and knocks on your door, which is totally unacceptable these days, because, God, if you're outside somebody's house, you better text them. But
exactly.
No, if somebody comes and knocks on your door, do you sit there and not answer?
I have not
answered
my front door, I'd say, in 20 years, give or take, maybe 19. I mean, that is the most intrusive.
How dare they
all.
Show up?
I'm totally serious about that. You look through the window if it's somebody who's not an enemy.
It's a good thing we're not friends, Jim, because with my friends, I'll just walk into their house. And
hey, Zane, Text me before you come, and you can come over anytime. Zane, thank you for the
call. I can just see
call.
You over there peeking out the curtain to make
Do you answer your door? Do you answer your door?
No.
That's a perfect corollary to this discussion.
I do not answer
and
the door.
And why do you not do that? You do answer the phone. You don't answer the door. Why do you not
Because the only
answer
people who are knocking on my door are the mass perd people asking me to sign something else. And
That's really not nice.
Well, no, I can't sign because I'm a reporter. And so I yell over the porch and say, are you from Mass Perg? And they say, yes, I am. And I say, I can't sign because I'm a reporter. But okay, they're very active in Brookline. And good for them, but I just can't sign.
Okay, fine. Let's go to Pete. You're in Dedham. You're next on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Thank you for your call. Hi.
Hey, yeah, I know I'm totally in Jim's camp. I'm a business-to-business salesman.
Yeah.
And so I can be holding 10 conversations in the digital world via email, text, or whatever. And quite often I'll get, and I have to admit it, quite often it's an age thing, I'll get an older client that just constantly insists on getting on the phone. And it's the most loss of productivity you can just ever imagine. You know, it's like you don't get that 10 minutes back. And it's just not effective anymore.
Well,
you
said it better than I. That's exactly right. Not only is it not antisocial not to use the phone as your primary communication vehicle, it's pro-social because you can communicate like Pete does with far more people in the exact same amount of time. Correct.
Correct.
Great.
No, I think if one of your best friends is calling and they're sobbing and in hysterics, I think the correct approach is, you know, send them a text.
No, but and you know what they'll do in that circumstance? I don't mean this in a hard-hearted sort of way. They'll text you and say, I just called you. Can you call me back as soon as possible? And in most circumstances, even people like me will call them back as soon as possible. I mean, it's just, by the way, for
someone
who is...
You'll call them back, Jim, and talk for 17 and a half seconds.
But you know what? I'm thinking about our phone relationship, though.
Yeah.
I almost always, unless it's urgent, I do say, is it okay to call? Are you callable?
That's right.
You never do that with me. You call if you need to talk to me, you just call. Why don't you text me first?
I do.
You,
I do.
No, you
I
do
often
not.
Text you. Yes, I do, because you don't answer the phone. So
I don't
I
look
text
at the
you.
Text either. Now, yeah. Think about it.
I always like the way Jim greets you on the phone, too. What do you got?
Well,
not, hey, how are you? What do you got?
No, we don't live that long, Marjorie. Trust me. And the more time
and
we're
boy,
focused.
Boy, I better have something, or, you know, he's gone. You know, oh, I'm trying to explain when I don't have anything, it hangs up, clicks. I tell you, to produce immediately.
Okay. You know what it is? It's
what?
A dead zone on the center of the street. I wasn't really
okay.
Hanging up on you.
Okay. Let's go to Ezra in Arlington. What do you think, Ezra?
Hi.
Hi. Yeah.
Hi there.
Whoops. Hi, Ezra.
Speaking of dead zones, we've got to put you on hold 1 second, Ezra, because it's a rotten connection. I think it's your cell phone. We'll get back to you as soon as we speak to...
Jeff on the Mass Pike. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, Jeff.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Excellent.
Great.
Thank you.
Jim, as usual, you're all wet.
Thank you. Appreciate your support, Jeff. Why is that?
I think it's kind of selfish to not answer the phone. Someone's taking the time to call you. They want to call you. They want to contact you. It's common courtesy. To answer the phone. It's selfish not to.
But what if it turns out, Jeff?
Okay. Defend yourself, Jim.
I, just like you, I live a life doing probably relatively similar things to you. Who has the right to decide when it is in my life or yours that I have time to be able to have a conversation with them? If I call you, what time do you eat dinner, Jeff?
Well, I understand your point. If I'm busy, if I'm having dinner with my family, like Marjorie said, it's kind of like the old days. You can't answer every call.
Right.
But to ignore a call because you don't feel like answering, oh, I'm sorry, I don't feel like it now, that's selfish.
I have many meals during the day, Jeff. And there's a certain level of selfishness, but I would say, and I agree with you, Jeff, I would plead guilty. But I guess my response is there's a certain level of selfishness when there are alternative methods of communication when you just decide you're going to make the decision as to when Jim or Jeff or Marjorie is available to talk. But, Jeff, thank you for a fine argument. We appreciate your call. Should we try Ezra again and see if she's ready?
We're going to give a shout-out again to Ezra in Arlington. Hi, Ezra.
How are you?
Great.
Good now. We got you.
Good. Well, I feel that we're becoming a society of introverts. And it starts with the phone. It starts with the emails. You know, people don't even say hi to each other anymore. I mean, they live in the same neighborhood for 15 years, and they can't even look at your face or in your eyes. It's I really would love to go back to the old days.
Well, so you are one who answers your phone, obviously, correct?
Yes, I do.
And if somebody knocks on your door, uninvited, but knocks on your door, let's say it's 7:30 at night, do you go answer the door?
Yes, I do. And if it's not a good time, I let them know politely and...
But don't you notice, one of the things I notice, Ezra, and maybe because I live close to a T-stop, but everybody's walking down my street and half of them are on the phone, you know, and the neighbors might be on the phone. So it's always, if you see a person, a real person, there's your neighbor, but you're, you know, the neighbor's in a conversation. You know what I mean? They don't want to talk to you because they're talking to some. Everybody's in a different place. Nobody's in where they are right now.
Well, you know, Ezra, the one problem you do identify, I think it is symptomatic of the fact that we have segregated ourselves from people in so many ways, whether it's texting versus talking, tweeting versus talking, video games rather than being out in the world. And I think you're right. People don't make – we've talked about this before. People don't make eye contact and – you identify a problem. Thank you for the call, though. We appreciate it.
Here's a great email from Edward.
What do you say?
Bring back the busy signal.
Yeah, that is a very good point.
That is a great
point, Edward.
Call
waiting is another
Edward.
Disaster.
Yeah, my sister has a busy signal. I mean, she's
really true?
She's living in the 1930s. She
have a rotary phone, too?
She actually has a rotary phone.
That's not
true. She has one left in the house, a rotary phone that has been there like, you know, since 1920 or something like that.
Who was that email? Edward?
Edward.
You know, I had not even
That's
thought about
point,
this
a great point, Edward.
Ages.
It solves a lot of problems.
If you have call waiting.
Take the phone off the hook, and then they can't get through. They can't leave you a message.
Well, you know what the other thing is? I told this. I'm not going to name
or
this person's
name. Or you weren't
home
when they called.
No, you know one of the great things what? Is there is a person who we used to work with who shall remain unnamed, who's a wonderful person, by the way, who calls me nonstop.
Wow.
He calls quite
yes, he does.
Regularly. And what I do, and all he does leave me voicemails, unlike the other. And you know what I do? I don't erase the voicemails. And you know what the consequence of that is?
Your voice box is full.
Which is the equivalent of busy in 2013. And if somebody really needs to get you, if they know your – no, I'm serious. If they know your cell phone number, then by definition, they have the ability to text you. Problem solved.
Jim, you know what you are?
What's that?
A very, very important man.
Someone just tweeted us. Her handle is Utterly Michelle. She says, my email inbox gives me heart palpitations. It's totally true. I used to love the novelty of email, and now it's a chore.
You know, that's another it's great true. Point. I mean, how much time? I have to go get one of these books now about how to manage everything. You know, how you manage the email and the Twitter and the email at work and the email at home. I mean, I feel like I'm spending half my life.
Yeah, but you know why the key, and I know you're not happy about this, the beauty and the reason they're as popular, the reason why tweeting in particular and texting to a lesser extent, you have to express yourself in a shorter period of time. One of you, and I say this in a very warm sort of way, when you do leave a voicemail, I think you'll plead guilty to this, occasionally the voicemail that I think most people would agree could have been left in, let's say, 20 seconds. Is this true or not? Sometimes it's 4 or 5 minutes. That used to be me,
Jim, like 10 years ago. I have realized for the last 10 years that you don't listen more than like a second. So there's no point.
A tweet is 140 characters. A Marjorie voicemail
is
a million and 40 characters.
Beautiful arguments. I work everything out, A, B, C, and D, for nothing. So now I've smartened up. It took me a while, but I eventually did.
Fine.
Okay, let's go to Andre in Marlboro. What do you think about answering the phone or not, Andre?
Well, I usually answer my calls when I get my calls. My pet peeve is when I call people back or text them and they don't respond, but they're on Facebook posting tweets and messages, which means that they're just ignoring my calls.
That I am with you. There, Andre, you and I are one. That is real. So you know they're around. And by the way, I occasionally do that. When I've left a message, Andre's gone. I've left a message or two for somebody. I will check. You probably don't do this, Marjorie, to see if they're tweeting, particularly if they're an active tweeter. And if they've tweeted within the time frame of the when I called, then you know that they are consciously avoiding your outreach, which is really a problem. By the way, the predicate for this conversation is a wonderful piece. We should give her credit again. It's called Why I Silence Your Call Even When I'm Free. It's wonderful, written by a woman, Kaylee Wolfson Widger. And you can Google it. It's in the New York Times. It's terrific.
Let's take time for one more?
Yeah, one or two more.
Okay. Carol on the Mass Pike. What do you think, Carol?
Hi,
Carol.
Hi. Good afternoon. I think we've forgotten to talk about the off button.
What? Oh, meaning on your phone?
If you have a cell phone, which many of us do, you can turn it off.
Right, but I think the calls that you receive while the phone was off are there when you turn it back on, aren't they, Carol? I think they are on my phone.
Yeah, they are.
You can turn it so that the whole device is absolutely off, do your work, go for your hike, have your dinner, go out to a restaurant, see a play, listen to a concert, and then turn the phone back on and check your voicemail.
But Carol,
close enough relationships that your friends know when you're reachable.
But don't you have the problem, and I think this is one of the things that happens with parents now, because the kids know they can reach you right away, and or people at work know they can reach you right away, and if you don't respond to them for 7 hours, you're viewed as kind of irresponsible.
I don't mean 7 hours. I have a profession, and I keep my phone on for clients, but I got a sense that part of this conversation was about personal calls and whether or not to take them, and I do think that people can set boundaries and in their personal time can decide, children being an exception or elderly parents, that the phone can be off. And Margie, I was sympathetic to your observation that when you see people on the sidewalk, they're all on their phone. And so is the problem that people don't want to be reached, or is the problem that we have very strange relationships now with our telephone?
We do.
Yeah, but Carol, let me say, the one point you make that I do agree with is if your phone is off, the caller knows that if they quickly go to voicemail that it is off, so they're not offended if you don't get back to them right away. But the problem with that is twofold. Some of us, even though we don't take calls, like to be in contact, number one. And number two, I get great excitement, I think Marjorie knows, out of some people who call me who I do ignore. And you can't have that pleasure if it turns out your phone is off. Carol, though, thank you for the call. Did you see what I'd say? A majority of people agree with me. There are other ways to communicate with people, other ways they can communicate with you, and they should use them.
I know, but it is sort of pathetic when you walk down any busy street. Sometimes you even see couples like this, you know, that are 20, that, you know, they're supposedly madly in love with each other, and they both get their face on the cell phone walking down the street.
How about at a restaurant when there are four people are texting at the same time?
I know. I was talking to somebody the other day that said, oh, I love to listen to you on WGBH. I ran to her at the supermarket. She took three calls. At the third call, I finally said, I have to go. She took three calls. I was talking to her. She answered the phone.
Another reason not to take them.
Anyway, okay. Up next, it's Open Mic with Brian McGrory, editor of the Boston Globe. We're going to talk to him about the government shutdown, about Kurt Schilling's travail. Stay tuned for that conversation. I'm 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. This guy joins us every single... I shouldn't say this guy. He joins us every single Wednesday.
Right.
At about this time, he's the editor of the Boston Globe. He would be Brian McGrory. Hello, Brian.
Hello, Jim Browdy. Hello, Marjorie. How are you?
Hello, Brian. I think he should have called you a distinguished guy. That would have been more...
I'll do that next week.
Okay.
Fine.
Brian, Michael Cranish had a great piece, which is so relevant to what's going on now with all the stalemate and the shutdown, federal shutdown, talking about whether the media, you know, the Fox and Rush Limbaugh on one side and MSNBC on the other side and all the voters tuning in for reinforcement to the outlets they agree with, whether this is really contributing to this total polarization we see. And, you know, you're a media guy, longtime media watcher. What do you think?
Well, I appreciate that, Marjorie. Can I just give a quick plug to what we've done down in Washington since February or March?
Oh, the Broken Cities.
When we launched this project called Broken City, looking way back then at the rampant dysfunction in the federal government and government in the age of hyperpartisan politics, and we have done 15 parts now to this series. Michael Cranish's Sunday Story being the most recent one, and we're very pleased with this. But Cranish had, I thought, a really terrific story on Sunday, looking at what was supposed to be the great democratization of the media, small d, and how all these different outlets, all these different broadcast outlets across the cable dial. We're supposed to better inform the vast audience, and instead just the opposite has happened. Instead of a better informed broadcast audience, what we've gotten are viewers who just simply go to the station that will basically fulfill their, you know, hard set beliefs. So conservatives go to Fox, liberals go to MSNBC, CNN has the worst ratings in the middle, and we end up with just a nightly slugfest on cable television, which really rips apart even further the two parties.
You know, it's even worse in some ways. Cranish makes the point. If all of them had switched to cable television, at least they're watching something about the news. I think his numbers, and there were fairly close to this. Something like 50 million people watched the broadcast news. I think it was 1980 he picked. I could be off a year or two. Now it's down to 22 million. And you'd say, well, the 30 million obviously went to cable. Only 2 million went to the top-rated cable television news show, which is Bill O'Reilly. Something like a million or less to MSNBC. So the bottom line is the vast majority of those people have decided to get news from nowhere other than maybe Jon Stewart or the Colbert Report or something. And they say that ESPN, for example, and HBO have captured a lot of that audience, sort of, I guess, because they're so disgusted with what their options are.
Hey, people who are, it's a great point, Jim, people who are 40 years old or younger have no recollection whatsoever of the complete dominance that the three major networks used to have in terms of their nightly newscasts. You know, Dan Rather and before him, Walter Cronkite, Peter Jennings on ABC, Tom Brokaw on NBC.
Yep.
I mean, they used to be kind of industry gods who... We don't have that anymore. We just don't have it anymore.
Did I ever tell you the story of me following Peter Jennings into the men's room at the New Hampshire Primary Hotel a couple of years? No. I'll tell you
what. I have not heard that. Usually any story involving somebody famous, you've told me about 20 times.
Yeah,
so I'm
heard
very
it.
Surprised at this one. It sounds like it may not end well
yeah.
in the restroom.
It didn't end great for me.
At least that often. But you know, one of the things about those guys, and they were all, of course, guys, Brokaw and Cronkite, you know, Huntley Brinkley, all those legendary guys, is that they took it fairly seriously. I mean, they were trying to, you know, every night highlight the big news stories. And you had this great quote in the Cranish piece from, I think, the guy, who's the reporter, Mickey Edwards, or Republican
congressman from Oklahoma,
who's on some show. And at the end of the show, and he's saying, he's a former Republican, as Jim just said, and he was criticizing the outliers in the Republican Party, the Tea Party people. And at the end of the show, the host says, you know, oh, come on, Mickey, it's just entertainment.
Yeah.
And Mickey says, well, no, people don't know it's entertainment. And I think that's one of the things, that there's a sense that everyone is cooking the books for their own side of the story, whereas I think before, if they were cooking the books on Huntley Brinkley and Walter Cronkite and Peter Jennings and Tom Brokaw, I didn't think so. I thought they were trying to get close to some kind of reality on the news.
A reality and authority. They were the voice of authority. And, you know, it's interesting. The Edwards quote was just spot on. But it's also... It's entertainment until it's not entertainment. And it's not entertainment when people like Senator Cruz take to the airwaves on Fox or on Rush Limbaugh's radio show and you know, deliver these ultimatums and various outlying beliefs about what has to happen in the U.S. Congress and the federal government today, rather than do it in committee rooms or in negotiating sessions or in conference committees with the Democrats. It the divide has never been this wide, and the media plays a significant role.
And by the way, I know you know this, and we talked about it with you last week, creates a huge opening for places like BostonHerald.com, Boston.com, and all those sort of places to fill the gap. Speaking of Globe reporting, two of your great reporters, Scott Allen and Andrew Estes, did a couple of pieces on the, let's call him the embattled Evan Dobell, currently the president of Westfield State, about his lavish spending. And there's a board meeting on October 16th, at which point he could be suspended, et cetera. I interviewed him based on those Globe stories the other night. Rather contentious. And here is what he said, Brian, when I read to him, not quite verbatim, but close to verbatim, some of the things that were reported in the Globe. Just listen.
Almost everything in the Boston Globe report, which we have a two-hour tape of, is all half-truths and some untruths.
Sure.
You asked me where they were wrong. They were wrong almost everywhere.
So I got a ton of emails after this interview the other night, as I say, rather contentious, and a constant theme through a lot of them, whether they agreed or disagreed with him on the merits, was, so what does the Globe do in a setting like that when a high-profile public figure who you guys have reported thoroughly about basically says they're cooking the books, they're making up all this stuff? What does the Globe do in response, if anything?
Well, we do what we've been doing all along, and that is we continue the hard-nosed, aggressive, straightforward reporting that we have done on him and on the situation out at Westfield State. If he wants to point to specific places where we had things wrong, and I don't think he did on your show, we will address that, we'll make it clear what wasn't wrong about it, or if something was wrong, and I don't know of anything that we did that was wrong.
Nor do I.
We'll come clean on that. But right now, I'm beyond satisfied that what we've done on President Dobell has been very accurate and, you know, is obviously bringing about some great consternation in the state government at this point, with the governor weighing in and the head of higher ed weighing in. And, you know, Evan Dobell doesn't look too good right now.
Well, Brian, I know you are a huge fan of Broadside Colon, the news with Jim Browdy, which is on NACN every night at 6 o'clock. Broadside Colon, that's his name.
Yes.
Excuse me. And you probably missed this interview, but I recommend you go back and watch it, because
Thank you, Margaret.
It was contentious, I think it was understating it somewhat. It was basically a slugfest. It ended this way, Brian, where Dobell says to Jim, you need to do your homework. And when Jim says to Dobell, you need to tell the truth.
Well, whatever.
It was. You will enjoy it.
Oh,
get a
Marjorie,
cocktail.
When you say I need to go back and watch it,
you mean do.
I need to go back for the 10th time and watch it. I've been playing it in slow motion. I've been looking at Jim's hand motions, the
Thank
whole
you.
Thing. What I do with every night show. It's
yes.
how I do it.
Hey, Brian, in all seriousness, considering who you are and how much you respect your paper and now you run your paper, when you hear somebody like that calling your reporters out, and we both, Marjorie and I both know Scott Allen and Andrew Yessi, two of the best in the business. What? How do you feel? How's that? What emotionally does that do to you?
I mean, God's honest truth, Jim, does absolutely nothing to me.
Really?
I mean, nothing. It's you have a public official who we have taken a very hard look at, and we have revealed in print on several occasions things that call into question his credibility and how he spent money, how he spent public money, how he spent foundation money, some what appear to be lavish spending habits that have gone beyond the pale. And if he wants to shoot back at us, I mean, sure, go ahead. It's not, the honest truth is, no, it bothers me not one bit.
Well, Brian, how many?
Let me just finish here quickly.
Sorry.
He's not just shooting back at us; he is firing back at the head of the board at Westfield.
That's correct.
He is firing back at anyone who dares scrutinize in any way what he has done at Westfield. So, if I'm a public official, one of the worst moments I could ever have is when your assistant comes in and says Andrea Estes is on the phone. it's not going to go well. And she's a fantastic reporter. Scott Allen is a fantastic reporter. I have every possible confidence in them, and I think we're doing a real public service taking a look at Evan Dobell.
Well, Brian, as you know, you've been a reporter for a long time, and so have I. It's sort of the last refuge of scoundrels is to blame the media outlet that outlined their sins. I mean, how many times have you heard from someone who you did a tough column on, I was misquoted, that was taken out of context, they got it wrong? I mean, that's what they always say. So I put a grain of salt in that whole thing, too.
Yeah, I mean, believe me, it's just what they do. But that's not to say that we don't take seriously what they do say. If there's something that we have done wrong, we will make it right. But I can't state emphatically enough here, there's nothing I see that we have done wrong here. And if he has specific issues about inaccuracies in any of the stories we've done about him, I would expect to hear from him, and I have not heard a word from him yet.
Now, moving on to something I know you hold near and dear, because I read your terrific book, and if people haven't read it, they should. Buddy, How a Rooster Made Me a Family Man. It's a great little romance. It's wonderful. You talk a lot about dogs in that book, because you're a big dog guy. So I wonder, I see this story in the Globe a couple of days ago about pit bulls. Their rising pit bull adoptions reflect the breed's changing image. Are you about to make a pit bull purchase yourself there, Brian McGrory? Have you turned around on the pit bull?
No, I mean, I guess I can probably say this. I can't stand pit bulls. I absolutely can't stand them. I mean,
bless
I've written
you.
Columns. I just cannot stand the breed. And I am so tired of people saying, you know, blame the owner, not the breed. It's like, give me a break. It's pit bulls are a breed apart from other dogs. It's I just don't like them. I don't trust them. I don't like them. They are strong. Their jaws are incredibly strong. I wouldn't want to be around one. I certainly wouldn't put a kid around one. I don't want to put another dog around one. But that said, you know, the paper is not my personal playground. And there is a push around the state that we discovered that more people in the suburbs are buying these kinds of dogs or are rescuing them from shelters, and we thought it was worth noting in print.
So we should say, we should mark you down as undecided on the issue. So, you know, yeah, Brian, we talked about the Globe piece. Who wrote that, by the way, Marjorie? Whoever?
James Burnett.
Oh, Burnett.
Yeah, the third. Very, used to be at Boston
Burnett
Magazine.
Yeah. Terrific. Yeah.
We talked about it on the radio yesterday. We got as much comment on that story here at WGBH as virtually anything we have done. And you dismissed just a second ago on a serious note this, you know, blame the owner thing. And went on to say you think it's in the breed. Let's assume they're right. And this is the point I was making repeatedly yesterday. Let's assume it is blame the owner. If the owner is doing an irresponsible job raising a very strong animal, and you are the one, or your kid is the one who ends up in the mouth of that animal, it's not much consolation to hear that the owner did a bad job, that it's his or her fault. Yeah,
agreed.
Okay, yes. Fine.
So, before we move on from that, I just have to share one other story about this. You know, Puppy Doe, the poor tortured pit bull puppy that everybody felt terrible for, because no one likes abusive animals. Brian, I went to the rally in Quincy. There were 700 people. I thought there were 500. Apparently, there were 700 people at a rally for this poor dog.
Well, it was one of the saddest stories.
It was a horrible story. It was a horrible story.
Really,
you couldn't even read it. It was so upsetting.
Yeah.
But I did feel an obligation to point out when I wrote a story about it that it does seem, you know, this is a dog, and there's certain oddness that people get that upset about dogs when they would get less upset about a murder, and, you know, all that kind of thing. I'm still getting trashed, you know, a week or 2 weeks later for my lack of empathy about dogs. I mean, there is this unbelievable thing about animals that people just go bananas. I think there were 50,000 people on Facebook raising money for revenge to catch the perpetrator of this torture.
Well,
against
I can
this
relate
dog.
To that. I don't buy into the whole dog is more important than human, even though some. But you totally have empathy for.
Everybody has empathy, but even pointing out the oddness of it, I guess, makes you. Not a real dog lover or something like that.
I remember many years ago, 2004, I wrote a column about making the decision to put my golden retriever down at the time. You get one great dog in life, and his name was Harry.
I remember the column. I was in tears.
I dreaded waking up the day the column was in print because I thought I would get hammered by readers saying, how dare you write about your dog when there are, you know, teenagers getting killed in neighborhoods that are too dangerous. And instead, I woke up and I literally had what I think were somewhere between 3,000 and 5,000 emails in my system by like 10 a.m. And I still get emails nearly a decade later about that column from people saying, relating to it. There's something about dogs that brings out the good in people.
Yeah, no, it absolutely does. You know, speaking of...
Notice I've never had a dog. I mean, that's sort of... Says everything you need to know.
We more than noticed, Jim. You with that whole, I mean, again, when you pet a dog, you don't bend your elbow.
Fine, Brian.
Marjorie,
fine.
Does he put one of those surgical masks on whenever he's around a dog?
I've petted Marjorie's dog on many an occasion, Brian,
yeah.
So don't worry about it.
My dog is only 10 pounds, so it doesn't make Jim too nervous. You know, Curt Schilling, I know he invested poorly in this video game company in Rhode Island, and he put $50 million of
his own money
in it. But now we all know that Curt Schilling and his wife, they're selling the furnishings of their big house, candlesticks and couches and vacuum cleaners, in a kind of a almost like a big time yard sale, estate sale this Saturday. How do you feel about this? What's the moral of the story here? I feel terrible.
So do I, actually.
I have a hard time getting my head around that. I do feel terrible. You know, it's on the one hand, he took a lot of public money down there in Rhode Island, didn't he, on the tax break?
Yes, he did.
He did.
So, you know, you don't feel so bad about that. On the other hand, he appears to have at least backed it up with his own money. And that's, a guy who made as much money as he did in professional sports and baseball, now seemingly not having... You know, not being set for life, and quite the opposite, having to sell off things like this, it's really tragic in some ways.
Yeah, it just makes you. And you know, his wife wrote a book about their child who's on the autism spectrum, Asperger's.
We
syndrome.
Had her on about it. She was great.
And you know,
Shauna Schilling.
There's a stereotype. You think, the baseball wife. I think a lot of people think it's not going to be a terrific book. It was a really compassionate book about parents comparing children. You know how that happens, especially in the suburbs where, my kid's better than you, or my kid's, and people looking at her as a bad mother because this child, because he was on the Asperger's syndrome, you know, would occasionally do things, have an outburst here or there. It was a terrific book. And for her, I feel particularly horrible.
Yeah, yeah. They were both, or they are both, extremely intelligent. I mean, you would have expected him to go on and be really successful in business after he left baseball.
Hey, Brian, speaking of the Red Sox, and I know you have to go to the rally in a couple of minutes. So I'll try to end this as quickly
with
as
with my colleagues, yeah, my new colleagues, David
yeah,
Ortiz.
Yeah, exactly. That was my next line. Thank you for preempting it. There is a fabulous piece we talked about a few minutes ago in the New York Times. I don't know if you saw it. When I Silence Your Call, Even When I'm Free. It's by this woman, Kaylee Wolfson Widger, who writes about even when she's doing nothing and a friend calls her on the phone, and she sees the number come up and she knows the friend is going through hard times and she loves her and they're really close. She never answers the phone. She never listens to the voicemail. All she does is text the person back. I pled guilty. I'm one of those people. I know it's not a big surprise. Marjorie is the opposite. Where are you on the answer the phone thing, particularly in your new life? When it I assume it's ringing nonstop. What do you do?
Boy, it's situational, but I wish I had something witty to say here. I don't. Look, here's the issue. I actually try to take calls because I don't want to have a long list of calls that you have to make back at some point. So why not address it just as it happens?
So if you see, for example, if my number came up on your cell phone.
That's different. That's not the question you
okay,
asked.
Fine.
That's much different.
No, that was the question. Brian McGrory, Boston Globe. It's a pleasure. We'll talk to you.
I just want to give you a hint.
What?
You don't have to worry about taking Jim's calls. You know why?
Why is that?
Because I have found, as someone who does take his calls quite regularly, that I'll be in the middle of a sentence and he'll hang up on me.
I got to
go,
Marjorie.
So they're always about 4.5 seconds long.
Am I not mistaken, though, and it gets very tricky, don't Jim's calls come in under a restricted number?
Yes, maybe they do.
Maybe they do. Maybe it's a blocked line.
It gets very, very dicey at that point.
Thank you for that, Brian McGrory. It's a pleasure. We'll speak to you next Wednesday, Brian.
Thank you, guys.
Go Red Sox. See you later.
Brian McGrory is with us every single Wednesday at 1 o'clock. Up next, psychotherapy is getting a bad name. It has an image problem. It is in decline. We're going to have that conversation up next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. When it comes to psychotherapy, given our culture of the quick fix, the idea of getting help by way of psychotropic drugs could seem far more appealing and practical than taking to a therapist's couch or chair. And if Big Pharma is dwarfing the true benefits of psychotherapy, Tony Soprano's visits to Dr. Melfi may not have helped either.
Nowadays, everybody's got to go to shrinks and counselors and go on Sally Jesse Raphael and talk about their problems. Whatever happened to Gary Cooper, the strong, silent type? That was an American. He wasn't in touch with his feelings. He just did what he had to do. See, what they didn't know was once they got Gary Cooper in touch with his feelings, that they wouldn't be able to shut him up. And then it's dysfunction this and dysfunction that. I had a semester and a half of college, so I understand Freud. I understand therapy as a concept. But in my world, it does not go down.
Joining us on the line to talk about psychotherapy's image problem is Brandon Gaudiano. He writes a recent Sunday Times op-ed on the issue. He's a clinical psychologist, assistant professor of psychiatry and human behavior, at the Albert Medical School at Brown University. Brandon, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So let me read, you sum it up so perfectly in the first paragraph of your piece in the Times. Psychotherapy is in decline in the United States. From 1998 to 2007, the number of patients in outpatient mental health facilities receiving psychotherapy alone fell by 34%, while the number getting medication alone increased by 23%. So what's going on here? Why did this happen?
Well, what's even more interesting about that is that over recent years, over the last few decades, there has been an explosion of research on psychotherapy, and we've learned a lot more about which psychotherapies are effective and can give people a lot of benefits. And yes, as you just noted, we're seeing a decline in that. So there are factors, a multitude of factors. Some are coming from within the field itself, and some are coming from external factors, like you said, the pharmaceutical industry.
And what are those external factors? I mean, is it big pharma has more money and has a greater ability to sell itself, to market itself, as opposed to the therapy community? What is it that they've got that the therapist world does not have, Brandon?
Well, I think that's definitely a big factor, is the money and resources that they can devote to marketing those products. So, of course, you see direct-to-consumer advertising on television quite a lot, and you don't see similar advertisements for psychotherapy. So that's a big influence. Another big influence, of course, is that a lot of people with mental health problems are being treated by more typical medical settings, and that's also then, I think, influencing people getting more the option of medication instead of psychotherapy, even if they might, if given the choice, choose the other.
Were you surprised by the numbers? When I read your opening paragraph, the numbers that Marjorie just read, I was stunned, actually. I would have, well, I would have suggested the number of people using drugs was up. I would have assumed that anything but a decline was happening with therapists. You know, I was going to say something that's only a bit of an exaggeration. Virtually everybody I know is seeing a therapist or has recently. So were you as surprised as I, or you could have predicted that?
Well, I think it depends on where you're looking at where people are getting psychotherapy and for what. I think for the more serious mental health conditions, the things like anxiety and depression that are very prominent, but at clinical levels, I think it's in those sort of mental health treatment settings that you're seeing less psychotherapy. When it comes to things like more for personal growth, coaching, maybe less severe problems, I still think you find a lot of people who have the means can do that. But again, it's very hard. A lot of people have a lot of difficulty with their health insurance plan. There are a lot more barriers to trying to get psychotherapy to treat, say, their clinical depression than if they chose a medication option.
Well, that was one of the things I was going to mention. But before I do, I'm going to give out the number if people want to call in and talk to you about this situation. 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Has this been your experience that you are using psychotherapy less frequently, or people in your family or friends or whatever, coworkers, and going more to drug treatments? You mentioned, Brandon Gaudiano, the whole issue of insurance policies. That's what I hear so often, mm-hmm. that one of the reasons that so many people are just getting drugs for their problems is that their insurance policies won't cover talk therapy.
Yeah, it's easier often with insurance policies that people might have, where the options for psychotherapy, the reimbursement rates might be, you know, there are less hoops to jump through than if you try to do the psychotherapy route. Also, there's an absence of providers who might be able to provide these psychotherapies that are evidence-based in the community. So people do have also a hard time finding people who are accepting their health insurance plan and can provide the types of treatments they might be looking for.
That's the voice of Brandon Gaudiano. He's a clinical psychologist, assistant professor of psychiatry and human behavior at the Alpert Medical School at Brown University. We'll get to your calls in a second. I want to add another factor. Despite the wonderful work of Tipper Gore, obviously Al Gore's former wife, mm-hmm. people like Mike Wallace, who talked about his depression, Catherine mm-hmm. Zeta-Jones talking about her bipolar condition, it seems to me there's still a huge stigma, unfortunately, to health issues that are inside your head that can't be seen. We hear this from military people returning from war who won't seek treatment mm-hmm. for PTSD and those kind of things because, yeah, I can see your broken arm. I can't see your broken brain. I know it is an expression you use, mm-hmm. but you know what I mean. Isn't this the continuing stigma part of the reason why drugs are on the rise and actual therapy, talk therapy, is on the decline?
Well, I'm not completely sure about that, but I do think certainly stigma is an important factor in general for people getting treatment and asking for treatment or feeling like they're embarrassed about getting treatment is still something we have to do a lot to overcome. And in fact, there have been a lot of public health programs that have meant to impact stigma over the years, and they haven't necessarily really been that successful. So there's a lot more to do with that. But actually, what's interesting is also when you look at the research, you find that pretty consistently when you do survey people and you ask them for their depression or if a family member had depression, what treatment would they like to be recommended or receive? And at a 3-to-1 ratio, they often choose psychotherapy over medication. So that's why it's a little bit of a disparity that you see where the actual rates of psychotherapy are going down in these settings, even though other studies show that people are actually interested in pursuing psychotherapy as an option. and in some ways, you know, might find that less stigmatized.
So how do you reconcile that response that they find it, whatever you said, 3-1 more appealing to them, for lack of better expression? And how do you reconcile that with the decline you talk about in the lead of your Times piece?
Mm-hmm. Well, what happens often is that people aren't always given all their options when it's identified. So they might go to a primary care doctor and they might fill out a questionnaire and that, you know, they might be told, well, you know, it looks like there's an issue here that needs to be addressed. And it might just sort of be easier in that setting to prescribe a medication than to really go through the options and have a person decide. They might have to, like I said, go out of their way to try to find the psychotherapy if that's what they're interested in. Primary care physicians might not have those services on site. Most of them don't. So it might be difficult to get a referral. So in a lot of ways, it just sort of funnels people more, I think, to the medication route. But one of the things in research is that, the long-term effects of psychotherapy, especially for depression, can sometimes be better than for medication.
Brandon Gaudiano, before we take calls, which we're going to do in a second, I played a clip from my favorite television show and one of my favorite scenes when Dr. Melfi is sitting across from Tony Soprano. Do fictional accounts of what life is like in a psychiatrist or a therapist's office, do they help or hurt the image of the psychotherapist? I mean, what was that is obviously, I assume, it's the highest profile in Shrink's office view that virtually any of us have ever had.
In Treatment, too, on HBO.
Well, that's true, yeah. Well, there are others, but I mean, I guess, so do fictional accounts help or hurt in terms of making people more open to talk therapy?
I think they have created a lot of myths in the public's mind about what psychotherapy is, because if you do look at something like The Sopranos, or if all you know about psychotherapy is what you saw in a Woody Allen movie, then I think you're going to be pretty confused as to what the process is actually like in the modern era, in the types of studied psychotherapies that I'm talking about. We call them empirically supported treatments because they've been tested in randomized controlled trials and shown to be effective. And these look very different than some of the classic depictions you see in the media about psychotherapy, where you're just sort of talking endlessly about your problems and nothing really is going on.
Speaking of, since you brought up Woody Allen and we didn't, we'll play you, for people out there, a little bit of what Woody Allen had to say about psychotherapy. Here he is.
I don't know. I was a nervous child. I was a bedwetter. I used to sleep with an electric blanket, and I was constantly electrocuting myself.
He's been depressed. All of a sudden, he can't do anything.
Why are you depressed, Alvy?
The universe is expanding.
The universe is expanding?
Well, the universe is everything, and if it's expanding, someday it will break apart, and that will be the end of everything.
It won't be expanding for billions of years yet, Alvy. We've got to try and enjoy ourselves while we're here, huh? Huh?
I know that certain characteristics about me are different now than they were when I started analysis. I started when I was 22, and I'm 35. So I have aged. That's something.
Now, Brandon, are you able to laugh at that, or you're too close to the situation to laugh?
No, I mean, I find you know, those things funny and The Sopranos and, you know, interesting. And, you know, I think it's just that there aren't really – some of the realities of psychotherapy aren't quite as entertaining and funny. So you just don't see them depicted that much. There's a lot of great fodder to be had in terms of some of those depictions. But they just don't really represent what we usually do these days.
Especially Woody Allen. 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. If you'd like to call in and talk to Brandon Gaudiano, he is, of course, a clinical psychologist and assistant professor of psychiatry and human behavior at Brown University's Albert Medical School. Let's take a call from Peggy in Needham. Hi, Peggy.
Hi, Marjorie. My question is for Brandon, and that is, I'm curious about the data regarding the number of people reflected in the decline in seeing psychotherapists. And my question relates to whether he included everybody, in other words, those who come through insurance and those who pay privately.
How about that, Brandon?
Yeah, well, like I said, this particular study that I cited, that had to do with what was happening in outpatient mental health settings in the United States. over a decade period. And so they're looking at declines. And you see that in various settings like that. So it's not necessarily in every that every psychotherapist has seen a that kind of decline in their practice. But the patients that people who need it most are getting treated are not getting as much psychotherapy as they were a decade ago.
Peggy, thank you for the call. Brandon, you mentioned a minute ago that there was some sort of public information, public education effort that was undertaken to get rid of the stigma or reduce the stigma around psychotherapy. Mm-hmm. I can't. I've seen everything else the government tries to do, cigarettes, whatever. What was the message? I'm not familiar. What did they try to do? What did they say?
Yeah, good question. What I was actually referring to was about just mental illness in general.
Okay,
that
sure.
There are public health campaigns for that. Now, a lot of them...
saying what? Seek help? That you can. What's the message there?
Yeah, well, the message is often that, this is not your fault. It's not something to blame. It's something that's a medical condition like, other medical conditions. So you shouldn't be afraid to get treatment. But what we find is that when you do the research on those kinds of approaches is that they can sometimes have unintended consequences. So sometimes by... suggesting to the person that this might be something wrong with their biology, let's say, they might infer other things that you don't want them to infer and might not be actually helpful for reducing stigma. Like they might feel like, well, if another person has that problem, well, they're different from me or they're fundamentally flawed. And we really don't think that that's always the best way to try to decrease stigma. What you want to do, actually, they found to decrease stigma is to help people to get more experiences and to learn more about the personal experiences of people dealing with mental illness and have more contact with them. That actually decreases stigma because they see that it's a problem. Like we all have different problems in our lives, and this is just sort of one facet of that.
Our number is 877-301-8970 if you have questions or comments about the alleged or not. Alleged, I shouldn't say. You've documented it. The decline in psychotherapy. Before we get to let's go to John from Gardner. Hi, John. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Marjorie and Jim. How the heck
are
you?
Hey, John.
Great.
It's great to hear from you. Hi, John.
Got off the golf course a little early today.
What's up, John?
You know, there's quite a history in my family, and I'm part of that. And I went through a real tough time last year. Thankfully, I'm kind of on the other side of that, and I'm doing real good now, and so forth. But my experience has been that. Virtually, talk therapy is like a whistling in the wind. It's just not available. You got to find through my insurance carrier, which I have good insurance. You guys know what my former job is, right?
Yeah, you work for the state.
Yeah. Well, I was in prisons, and right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I work for the state, so I have a good insurance plan, and you have to find a provider that matches up with your plan. I just went. Maybe 15 minutes you meet with the guy and you chat a little bit, but it's all about what medication is going to get prescribed. Not that that's necessarily a bad thing, but that's, what I found to be the case. And I think talk therapy is, I just don't think these days it's available to the regular Joe, unless you're paying big cash.
Yeah.
Well, is that true?
I think you hear that too. Or most people they can't afford. A lot of psychotherapists won't even take insurance, as you mentioned before, Brandon. And so people mm-hmm. can't afford it. What do you think about John's call?
And John, we're glad you're doing well. Yeah,
thank you, John.
Yeah, I've heard from a lot of people after writing the piece, emailing me and calling me and sort of expressing similar concerns that. They just really don't know where to find somebody. They don't, have the resources to do it. And that is one of the major hurdles as to why you're seeing this decline is that, that they're not being offered. A lot of times, like I said, there just aren't psychotherapists that people are within the vicinity of who provide the types of treatments that are research-based. So a lot of the concern also comes from within the psychotherapy community that we could be doing a better job of training professionals, of promoting those kinds of treatments and making them more available. But, it really takes a concerted effort to do that. And just to give you an example, in the United Kingdom, they recently spent $300 million to train psychotherapists to do evidence-based treatments for depression and anxiety because there was such a need and because the studies actually showed that it was more cost-effective for them to provide psychotherapies like that than medications. And so they had to have that kind of a program to start getting people more trained and making it more available. We don't have anything analogous to that really going on in the U.S.
Well, one of the things you point out, too, is that I think a lot of us have this image that talk therapy is just sitting around talking. But it's not just that, right? There's cognitive behavior, learning how to deal with your anxieties, things you can do to deal with those, or mindfulness training, all these things that I think lots of us don't even know about.
Well, that's the thing. The kinds of types of therapies that I'm talking about that have been studied are often very active. They're coping-based. They're really based on this idea that people have habits and things that they've learned that aren't working for them. And so there's a lot of retraining and learning new ways of coping and new ways of dealing with problems. And that takes a lot of active participation within the session itself, but also a lot of out-of-session activities that people engage in. And, so it is a process of relearning, and that's why maybe sometimes people who do that find that there are benefits that last beyond the time that they get the therapy. So even if they get the therapy for, say, 4 months and they get better from their depression, you know, that can prevent relapse in the future because they've learned something that they can then also use in the future if stress comes back.
Let's try to squeeze in one more call for Brandon Gaudino. Nick, you're in the car. You're on Boston Public Radio. Thank you very much for the call. Hi.
Hi there. Love the show.
Thanks.
Long time listener, first time caller, anyway.
Thank
you.
So I have bipolar disorder and ADHD, and I've been going to therapist since I was like 12, and I'm 42 now, and I take medication for those, and I've had mixed results with therapists over the year, and I'd love to go to talk therapy. I just really don't have the time. You know, I'm married, I have a job, I have a couple kids. You know, I just can't squeeze it in anywhere.
How much do you hear that, Brent?
Part of it, you know.
Mm-hmm. How much do you hear what Nick is suggesting in a very busy world, Brandon?
I think that's true, and I think that people just need to realize they have choices. For example, let's just take clinical depression. Really, the research shows that it's mainly based on the person's preference that they should get the treatment. So a lot of people prefer psychotherapy and want to give it a try. Other people might not have the time. They might not be really interested in talking to somebody, and they choose medication. We find that in studies that do that, that both people, if they choose the treatment that they want to engage in, then they do it, they'll both get better. So it's partly based on a person's preference, and sometimes people prefer one or the other. I think the big issue, of course, is that a lot of people who prefer psychotherapy aren't given that option, and I think that's what we want to try to correct.
Hey, Nick, thank you so much for the call, and Brandon Gaudino, thanks for your great piece in the Times, and thanks for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. Brandon Gaudiano is a clinical psychologist and assistant professor of psychiatry and human behavior at the Alpert Medical School at Brown University. The piece that we've been talking about today was in the New York Times. It's called Psychotherapy's Image Problem. Okay, when we get back, we're going to talk to Larry Ruttman from Brookline about his new book, American Jews and America's Game, which is baseball. That conversation is up next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. The timing for today's conversation could not be better. Last night, Boston Red Sox pitcher Craig Breslow struck out 4 batters in a row, and that's particularly relevant because he's Jewish. Joining us in Studio 3 to talk about where Breslow ranks, among other great American Jewish baseball players, is Larry Ruttman. His new book is called American Jews and America's Game. Larry, it's great to finally meet you.
Nice to meet you, Jim. Thanks very much. Hi, Marjorie.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for coming in. So why'd you write this book?
Well, I guess I wrote this book because, I've been Jewish since I was born. I was bar mitzvah.
I'm Jewish. I didn't write the book.
But I've never been an observant Jew, but I've always been proud to be a Jew. And I love baseball.
Yep.
Since I was a kid. I go back to Ted Williams. I'm 82 years old, still going strong.
Wow.
And
God,
so,
you look great. You're taking your vitamins, Larry.
Thank you very much. Well, Marjorie, I think you have a great voice.
Oh, thank you.
She's taking your vitamins, too.
I mispronounce a lot of things, but I hope you don't mind that.
And I just think it was a natural thing, and I love America, so that I think the book is really, I think of it as about America, about baseball, about American Judaism. It's really one-third, or it's about all of it. It's not really just about baseball. It's really an anecdotal social study of American Judaism going back 80 years. And thank God the critics have seen it that way. They see it as a book that has a further reach, and the Amazon rankings give it high marks in biography and history.
So, good for you.
Wait till you're done here, Larry. I mean, you ain't seen nothing yet. You know, Larry, if you were to say to the average person in the street, name a Jewish baseball player, I think everybody, well, most everybody would think of Hank Greenberg. They think about the reclusive Sandy Koufax. But there are a ton of people, both in the management side of baseball, from Bud Selig, who obviously is the current commissioner, to the guy who changed the game completely, Marvin Miller. You talk to a ton of people inside the game and on the periphery of the game. Tell us some of the names whom we might not think of.
Well, when you mentioned Bud Selig, he wrote the foreword for the book, and he also, I interviewed him, and he's one of the stories in the book, and he's a great guy. He's a peacemaker. I think that there are some things that people will criticize in his being the commissioner about the drug thing, but he made peace between the players and the Major League Baseball, and that's very strong. You mentioned a couple of people. I want to say Craig Breslow is in the book as well, and that was fantastic what he
Yale
did last
kid,
night.
Right?
And Marvin Miller is a guy that I love. I developed a relationship with him when I interviewed him when he was 90 years old 5 years ago. He died a year ago, October. He was a Hamisha guy, as they say in Yiddish, really down to earth. And, you know, he was demonized by the owners back when he was the representative of the players, but he's nothing like that. You know, I sat down with this guy for 3 hours. I flipped on the digital voice recorder. He became my friend, then my uncle, then like my grandfather. I spoke to him within 30 days of his dying.
Wow.
And I read to him the edition I made in the book where his portrait hangs in the Supreme Court of the United States because he was a friend of Arthur Goldberg's. And Goldberg, of course, got off the court and helped Marvin when he represented Curt Flood in the fight over free agency.
The St. Louis outfielder who filed the free agency suit that essentially changed baseball forever.
That's right, Jim. And what I wanted to read to him was that that I got into the book at the last minute was how his portrait is there. The only non-lawyer, the only non-justice. And my punchline was good enough for the Supreme Court of the United States, but not good enough for the Baseball Hall of Fame.
He's not in the Baseball Hall of Fame.
He's not in the Baseball Hall of Fame. That's absolutely a travesty of justice.
By the way, he was not a lawyer. He was an economist. Obviously, he created the league's first collective bargaining agreements in 68. Here's part of that digital voice recording conversation. Miller is talking about how players basically had no power against owners at that time.
When the players first approached me about becoming the first executive director. Sure, I had been a baseball fan ever since I was a small boy, but I decided there was much I did not know. And so I began to read everything I could. I remember my feelings at the time of that. It was a feeling of indignation.
Now, when you spoke to people like Miller and Selig, and we're going to talk to some of the baseball players, the contemporary ones, the Breslows, the Euculuses, some of the ones who are historical figures, did they say that being Jewish was part of the reason why they were as successful at being a commissioner or a baseball executive or a first baseman? Did they make that connection or no?
Yeah, I think they made that connection in many instances. You know, of the 50 people I interviewed and the 43 stories, the thing that struck me was that everybody's story is different. Some people were identified themselves as having a Jewish identity, even if they weren't Jewish, like Ian Kinsler. Marvin Miller, you know, you can just hear in his voice in that clip that you just played, Jim, the gentleness of the man, the decency of the man, how he was not over the top. So that I think that, but yes, they did make that. Kevin Euculus grew up in a family that observed Judaism in Cincinnati. Craig Breslow, whom we've mentioned, grew up in a family that was observant, his mother and father both teachers. But he did tell me that being in the major leagues, and this was 5 years ago when nobody recognized him as a major leaguer particularly, that, you know, because of the fact that he was out there in a world that was American, so to speak, rather than Jewish, he might wind up intermarrying. He's getting married in November. I don't know whether she's Jewish or not.
We're talking to Larry Ruttman, whose new book is American Jews in America's Game. You know,
a Brookline boy, we should say.
A
like
Brookline,
Marjorie
that's right,
Egan,
a Brookline,
yeah.
Which is a very Jewish community. I live in Brookline, too.
Oh, good.
And there's a stereotype, I think, that Jewish people in general, forget being baseball players, just aren't athletic. Well, it's true. Where does that come from? It's rather unfair.
Well, I think that comes from the fact that when the Jews, when the Eastern European Jews came into this country in 1890 from 1920, they came from shtetl communities in Poland, Ukraine, Russia. And, you know, the sport of the day was, I don't know whether they played chess, but the sport of the day was to study the Talmud, and they didn't have playing fields, and the rabbi was not a coach.
So it's just a different tradition then.
Well, no. What happened is they came over to America, and they the young boys, much to their to the chagrin of their mothers and fathers, started playing baseball. So that, but the guy that that Kahan, who ran the Jewish Forwards, you know, the forward that came out every day in Yiddish and English, said, no, let them play. That's the way into American society. So first the English started it, but then the Irish came along and they played baseball way into the society. The Germans, the Italians, the Poles, the Slavs, you know, we got Musial, we got DiMaggio, we got Babe Ruth, the Germans.
Yeah.
And the Jews.
Okay. You know, by the way, I want to get back to the stereotype that Marjorie says is unfair. Have you ever spoken to a 6'5" Jewish person who struck out in slow pitch softball before? Have you ever done that? You're talking to him right now. Theo Epstein.
He's big or small, Jim. You got to hit the ball.
Exactly. Well, in my case, unfortunately, I was not. Theo Epstein, obviously huge in the two historic World Series wins, 2004, 2007. Obviously, he's now the president or some such thing of the Chicago Cubs. What was that like? What was that conversation like?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, I mean, you're a lawyer and I'm a lawyer, so that we know that there are lawyer tricks. And even though lawyers do a lot of good stuff. Like
they do
you
a lot of wonderful things.
Like you did in the South Bronx.
Thank you very much.
But, you know, I think what happens with Theo is that he's a very he's a close to the vest individual. So I'm saying to myself, and I interviewed him down in Fort Myers, and he comes into the room, and I said to myself, he's liable to want to interview this thing fast. I really got to catch his interest. And sure enough, 10 minutes after we got into the interview, a knock comes on the door, and his secretary says, you want it on the field, Theo. Yeah. And I said to myself, he says, no, no. He says, I'm going to do this for a while. So and he stayed with me for about 25 or 30 minutes. And he actually gave me some personal information. You know, he has a twin brother, fraternal twin brother.
Paul
totally
Epstein,
different
right?
guy. Yeah, but I
a
mean,
beloved, was he guidance
school,
counselor at Brookline
at the
High School?
Brookline High School social worker,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
Great guy.
Very
people,
outgoing.
Kids loved him.
Very handsome guy.
Very
you
handsome.
Know, big, tall, like you. Didn't strike out, Jim.
By the way, I spent 30 minutes with Theo Epstein years ago for NECN.
Didn't work
and
out.
The single rudest person, in all seriousness, I've ever interviewed from any profession. It's just, but obviously,
he
everybody has
Larry.
Different experiences.
He liked Larry, didn't like you, Jim.
Well, I think that says something about the interviewer, doesn't it? So who? Let's hear a little Kevin Youkilis, by the way. Obviously, everybody connects to him, even though he's a Yankee now. Here he is talking about the big mention he got in the great book Moneyball, made into a movie, and his heritage. Listen to Youkilis.
It's funny they call me the Greek god of walks. I'm not Greek at all.
What is Youkilis?
Well, we took the name back in the day. We're in Europe. We're Romanian and Jewish, and of course, we're nomads and running around all across Europe and just trying to survive and all that stuff. So they got the name Youkilis, and if you ever meet a Youkilis, we're all related. So,
get out of here, yeah?
Yeah, so it's pretty cool. Uh-huh.
You know, we interviewed him a couple of years ago, and we brought this up. He wasn't on for that reason, and he had just been admitted into the Jewish Athletes Hall. He took that, as he should, as an incredibly huge honor. It was clear he was emotionally moved by it. It meant a huge amount to this guy, which I frankly didn't expect. So he's somebody who does identify with his heritage, it appears. Yes?
Very much, very much.
You know, Larry, I'm wondering, Sandy Koufax is a guy that is very famous. I knew him, you know, I didn't know him, but I obviously heard him when I was a kid. But he is very reclusive. He didn't want to talk even to you for this book?
Well, Marty Appel is my publicist. You know, yep. he's the guy that wrote The Pinstripe Empire. He's a great guy, he's written 20 books. And
wow.
he knew Sandy, and he spoke to Sandy about me. And Sandy called me one Saturday morning, and I pick up the phone. Hello, Mr. Ruttman. I said yes. This is Sandy Koufax, and I'm in the back of my mind. I'm like, my God, you know. But I kept my cool and talked to him, and he said, "I called you to tell you I don't want to be interviewed. I'm in my 70s, and I don't want to do what I don't want to do." So I said, "Well, Sandy, I'm in my 70s too." I'm thinking, how do I do this? And I said, "And I don't want to do what I don't want to do either." But I said, how about you write it and send
it
to
me? That's great. Well, at least he was respectful enough to call.
So what happened?
He was wonderful. You know, he said no, and I thought of another idea. He said no. But then I said, you know, Sandy, I said, well, I'm amazed doing this book. There's so many great people that come from Brooklyn. I mean, whether it's Barbara Streisand or Alan Dershowitz, who's in the book.
Huge baseball fan, we should say. Dershowitz is,
oh, yeah,
right?
He's a great baseball fan. And he's, you know, he's a great guy on a personal level. He's a fighter in public, but
right.
A terrific guy. So that So he said, oh, yeah, Brooklyn. He liked talking about Brooklyn. So at the end of the conversation was Sandy and Larry. We've had about six or seven subsequent conversations. I wanted to put him on the front of the book with a great drawing I found in the Hall of Fame that he hadn't seen, that, and it's in the book now as the frontispiece. He said no. Finally, I called him up and I said, okay, I've had it out with the publisher, Hank Green. I said, I got something to tell you. He says, cut to the chase, Larry. Said a few more words, bottom line. And I said, you're not going to be on the cover. He said, not going to be on the cover. He said, that's terrific. Hank started it all. Talk about reclusive. And he said, but you know that picture you found in the Hall of Fame? You can use it.
Well, that's pretty great. We only have 15 seconds left. Speaking of Koufax, is it not true that he either postponed or did not pitch in a World Series game because it was Yom Kippur? Is that correct? Which obviously is the Day of Atonement.
First game of the 1965 World Series, he didn't pitch because it was Yom Kippur. That's why he's famous today, because in the fifth and seventh games of that World Series, he pitched two shutouts on 2 days rest to win the pennant, to win the World Series for the Dodgers. That's why Sandy Koufax is remembered, because of that strength, that respect for his religion, that athletic ability, that determination.
Larry Rubin, great book, great interview. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you very much for coming in, Larry.
Thank you both.
And let's give the title of the book again. Larry Rubin's new book is American Jews and American Game. And thank you guys for coming in. Thank you, Larry, for coming in. Tune in tomorrow for Open Mic with Christopher Lyon. We're also going to go over the new Supreme Court docket with law professor Renee Landers. I'm Marjorie Egan.
And you can follow her on Twitter at Marjorie Egan. I am Jim Browdy. You can follow me at Jim Browdy. You can follow the show at BOS Public Radio. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you tomorrow at noon. Bye.